Hey, welcome to Textual Healing. I'm your host, Mallory Smart. Except today I'm not actually your host. Kirstie McKenzie is the author of Better to Beg and mastermind behind Major 7 magazine, which is kind of perfect because that entire online lit mag focuses on music and literature. So she was the ideal person to interview me about my book, I Keep My Visions to Myself, which also is heavily entwined with music and literature and all that fun stuff. I have no idea what wild questions she's going to ask me, so let's just get to it.
My name's Kirstie McKenzie, and I'm the guest host for Textual Healing today. I'm interviewing Mal because she released a book. She released I Keep My Visions to Myself, and the publisher is With an X Books. It's out now, and this is a long overdue conversation. We're going to talk a bit about, her inspiration for it and maybe her vision for it as well. She's not keeping the visions to herself today. She's going to spill about it. And about the playlist that informed it. Are you okay if we dive right into the playlist stuff?
Oh, yeah. Which playlist are we going off of?
I want to use the I Keep My Visions to Myself playlist.
All right.
That one made the most sense to me.
That's cool.
And I noticed as I was scrolling through and like listening to your songs. Sorry, that's just my cat. She's being a little idiot.
I could slightly. That's actually fun.
Yeah, hopefully she doesn't start trying to meow during the middle of it. But I noticed as I was going through this playlist that there's a lot of different influences in there. There's like very obviously a 70s influence. You've got like Jefferson Airplane, Patti Smith, Bob Seger, Fleetwood Mac, obviously. But there's also like some 90s influence. You've got Beastie Boys. And you've got, you know, like a little bit of present day influence as well, Father John Misty. So it very much reflects to me the fact that this is kind of a book out of time. Like there's 70s influence, there's 90s influence, there's present day. And the playlist to me really reflects that. So tell me a bit about whether you wanted to play with time or just like pay respect to different eras in music and, like how time sort of factored into your vision for the book.
I mean, like diving right in, I guess I'm not sure how intentional I was with time at first. There was always going to be that weird Fleetwood Mac influence, but I wasn't sure where I wanted to go from there. I guess I just started pulling from how someone like Stevie might grow up and what music she might have been surrounded by. She has a mother who is almost frozen in time when it comes to a certain rock era and likely had those songs on in the background of Stevie's entire childhood. But then she's also in LA and works at a record store. So I started pulling from dorky music discussions I've overheard at record stores or standout songs that might actually influence an action I've done or witnessed other people do and might correlate to something that Stevie might do. So when you mentioned Beastie Boys, the only reason I included that is the dorkiest reason. I talk about how the main character decides to make brass monkeys with her ex-boyfriend's roommate, and it just brought me back to an experience I actually had where I did do that. We didn't make the brass monkeys the right way, though. I was told that you make brass monkeys by putting PBR with orange soda. I was 18. Don't judge.
No judgment here.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're 18, it's like kind of whatever gets you fucked up, right? Like, that's usually the way it goes.
But no, I mean, everything was just made me think of like what reminded me of Hollywood. What was that feeling? So when you say Father John Misty and everything, I get that like Laurel Canyon vibe.
Yeah. And so to me, when I look at the playlist, like the 70s influence is so heavy on both the playlist, obviously as you were writing the book and on the main character, Stevie. Is there something in particular about the music of that time that really you know, captured you and made you want to write the book to begin with? Or did that kind of like evolve as you started writing the book? Was that a thing that, I guess I'm asking, like, did it come in before or did it come in after you started drafting?
Oh, actually, I didn't really draft that much. That's actually the fun part about this book, is it just started pouring out of me. I would say that a lot of the songs informed the writing more than the other way around.
And do you have any favorites on there? Like, I was really excited to see Hurdy Gurdy Man because I love that one. It's like, it's so, and it felt so you too, just because, like, to me it's so, this is like a bit of a segue, but it's so entrenched with the Zodiac movie.
So you understand why I actually put it?
Yes. Okay. Like, not surprised to see it on there for sure. And I just thought it was like a good balance of all those different songs. And like Fleetwood Mac obviously has an outsized influence on this playlist and on the book. Do you want to talk a bit about your relationship with Fleetwood Mac? And like, I know you have like a pretty storied history with Rumours and like the vinyl with Rumours and things. So like, if you want to tell us a bit about that.
Well, I mean, I don't actually know. These days, I've been really, really into Fleetwood Mac, and that's just probably because Fleetwood Mac is everywhere. I go on TikTok, and you can't get away from the Silver Springs algorithm. But my history with Fleetwood Mac kind of began right when I was just starting to dabble with the idea of being a writer. I had a friend who was really into beat literature, and we'd hang out, and like we'd be playing mandolin and like guitars and everything and tambourine outside of a Denny's in the middle of the night, because that's the only place you can go to after midnight in the suburbs. And he was obsessed with Fleetwood Mac. Like, he would actually like pull me into his car and be like, we need to listen to this album. Not in a creepy way, I'd like to point out. Like, this is definitely like a brother-like friend.
Yeah, and I think that like everyone has this sort of, Fleetwood Mac's definitely having, I don't want to say a renaissance, because it's like they never really left. I feel like
having a moment.
Yeah, like there's just successive generations of like people discovering Rumours and discovering Fleetwood Mac. And I feel like Daisy Jones and the Six has had an influence on that. Viral videos have had an influence on that. Obviously that clip of Silver Springs, like from the 1997 concert, like makes the rounds all the time because it's so intense. And I feel like everyone has this moment where they just like discover Fleetwood Mac. So how old were you when you discovered Rumours and you were just like, I'm so obsessed with this story and this album?
I mean, I was pretty resistant to it at the beginning because his name is Patrick, my friend who got me into it. He just would never stop playing it. And I don't know if you ever had that experience where someone is determined to push like music on you and you're just like, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think everyone has that experience.
But eventually I got into it.
Yeah, that's good. I think, too, like, everyone has their own personal relationship with Rumours. And, like, I know everyone kind of has, like, their own opinions about it and stuff. How when you were drafting Stevie, you were, like, kind of conceptualizing her as a character. I know that like the Stevie Nicks connection is obviously very present, and there's like that kind of, you sort of write about the influence, but also the shadow mm-hmm. of it, like the shadow that casts over her character. And what drew you to tell that shadow and that story particularly, and like how it kind of ties in with her relationship with her mom? Like it feels to me almost like Stevie Nicks is like a bit more maternal to Stevie than her mom actually was. Like that was kind of the vibe that I got when I was like reading it.
There is something semi-maternal about Stevie Nicks. Not quite motherly, more like godmother or aunt-like influence instead. She gives off big childless aunt energy in the best way. She's just another example of a path that we can take. There's a quote by her in the beginning of the book that I feel kind of informs Stevie, the character's relationship to Stevie Nicks. Let me find it. All right. Most women would not be happy being me, people say, but you're alone, but I don't feel alone. I feel very unalone. I wanted the character Stevie to have that vibe, the understanding that you don't need to be the person that other people are pressuring you to be for society's sake, or in this case, for her mother's sake. And you could just find your people and just be. Her mother is consistently in the corner of her mind trying to enforce a certain role for her to fit in. And I like the idea that ironically, through her mother's obsession with Stevie Nicks, she found that path instead.
Yeah, and I feel like in a way, Stevie Nicks doesn't just have this sort of maternal influence on, like, Stevie the character. I feel like that's something maybe we've all felt at a certain time, is that she's just this, like, mystical goddess being that, like, writes these songs that sort of resonate across generations, and she means so much to so many different people. So I thought it was really great to kind of have Stevie the character grapple with things that Stevie Nicks grappled with, you know, in the 70s when she was kind of coming of age and suddenly in this huge rock band and they were poised for fame. And, like, you know, she had so many setbacks when it was just her and Lindsey Buckingham. And, like, I don't think that there's probably any way she could have, like, foreseen how big things were going to be. But I guess that sort of informs my next question a little bit, is that this is a book very much in conversation with music. And I sort of, like, I get frustrated sometimes, and I say this as a person who wrote a book about musicians, but I get frustrated with books about music sometimes because I feel like if you set out to just describe the music itself, or like the making of it, or like the act of performing, then it doesn't make for a very good book. And so what I like that you've done with it here is you've written around that. Like, there's very little performance that actually goes on in the book, and there's, you're writing around it in terms of, like, there's this kind of navel-gazy thing that artists do where they are just their own worst enemy. And I like the book. I think it's stronger for that. And I think to write effectively about music or any other kind of art or any other kind of artist, you kind of have to write around the practice. And I wondered if you grappled with that while you were writing this book, about whether or not to include scenes of her performing, or if you set out very intentionally to kind of write around the performance aspect and just keep it to, like, the things that she grapples with in terms of, like, success and fame and where inspiration comes from, and, you know, how do you keep people around that inform that inspiration? I was just curious if it was something you set out intentionally to do or to, like, avoid, or if that was just, like, how it developed as you were drafting.
I mean, I think a lot of it came from the idea that music is just something she happens to do. It's not something that she wants to be, like, as her sole identity. And that's why I actually didn't want to have too much of her performing. I know I added a prologue just to give people context as to what's going on. That was actually written, like, way after the fact. The only times that I actually have her actually playing music are the two songs that I include in the book. I'm, like, literally looking at my book as we're talking because it's been so long. But
it's your reference material. You can do whatever you want with it. I think it's good to, I have it on hand as well, but I'm trying not to, like, rely on it too much. I feel like I'll let you speak for it.
Oh, that's all right. I have to rely on it right now, too. You know, it's funny, like, when you do these interviews a lot, it's usually, like, way after you wrote the book. So then you're like, what did I write? What was
the purpose? Like, I'm not responsible for this. That was a different person when I wrote that. I don't remember anything.
I almost
want
to write that. I almost just want to be like, this is not, like, once you talk to Mallory, she is no longer the Mallory that wrote this book.
Yeah, kind of. I think, too, when you write books and you sort of release them into the world, they're no longer yours, right? You don't really have any. And in some ways, that's what the work itself is grappling with, is, like, legacy. And not just, like, inspiration or where you're drawing from, but also the fact that, like, once stuff goes out into the world, be it books or songs or whatever it is, it's not yours anymore. You don't have any control over it once it's out there, and you don't have any control over the way that people are responding to it. So much of Stevie's kind of central tension or central like conflict in the narrative is that relationship with like lack of control over her fame and the success that she's seeing, and you know, whether or not she can follow that up with more inspiration. Like, there's a lot that's out of her control. And I think ultimately what she finds is that the only thing we have in our control is just the effort we put into it, right? And what we bring to the songs and how true we can be to our voice. I liked that a lot about it. I like that you engaged with that. And there was also kind of like, I guess, do you want to talk about the 90s influence too? Because it felt very... there was definitely like nods to Empire Records in there for sure.
It's actually very funny. People are gonna hate on me so much. I actually never saw that movie until I wrote the book. Like,
what?
Afterwards.
Seriously?
Yep.
That's shocking to me.
Yeah, I love High Fidelity.
Oh,
like,
wow.
That.
Because there's that scene in the book where they're like in the record store and they're pulling albums to like play, and they're sort of bonding over that. And to me, that felt very Empire Records. That's so shocking to me. I think that's also very cool though, because Empire Records is such like a cult classic. And to have like written this and sort of channeled that without being aware that you were channeling it, I think that's very cool. And I think it also speaks to like a thing that we're all kind of searching for, right? Is like that quote that you had about Stevie Nicks feeling unalone, like the epigraph of the book, dovetails really nicely into this notion of tribe that occurs throughout the book, mm-hmm. and how Stevie's looking for her tribe. And I wanted you to maybe explain for people who haven't read the book yet, how the notion of tribe influences your work, and also like how it plays sort of a central theme in the book as well. Cause I love that notion of trying to find your people and trying to find people that get it. And I loved that you engaged with it so much. So let me know how you find tribe in your own artistic life and how that you sort of funneled that into the narrative.
I guess the main thing is I don't feel a particular closeness with my own family. So I always tried to come along with the idea of creating my own family. So I don't know, anytime I find someone where I'm just like, you seem like you have the same motivation and spirit that I have, then I try and kind of insert myself into that person's life as much as they'll allow me. That's why a lot of people compare me to the Claire character.
Oh, that's fair. But I didn't know that they compared you to the Claire character. Is that something you've been hearing a lot since you've released the book?
People who are from my tribe.
Oh, fair enough. Okay. So like a little bit of a self-insert. We're given to that sometimes as writers. I agree with that. That sort of comes across that notion of like finding your people when you're not necessarily close with your family. And certainly that's something that sort of sticks with Stevie, like having a tempestuous relationship with her mom. And I think that found family is just as important as actual family, sometimes more important, right? Because it's the people who actually see you and maybe not people that you're sort of performing for or feel obligated to. And there's that really wonderful scene where Stevie is hanging out with Claire and who's the other character?
Finn?
Yeah, Finn. I was like, what was it, Finn? I know he's like the DoorDash driver, but they're all hanging out together and they're just sort of musing about art and about life, and I wondered if those were conversations that you have with your own tribe.
Definitely. Yeah. I've definitely had those exact experiences, like how I just described about how I would hang outside of Denny's at like 2 a.m. and be playing music with my friends. That's the kind of stuff we would talk about. My husband was actually joking around when he read that part, saying that it reminded him of times when we would be smoking hookah on my driveway, and some of our friends would hang out, and we would just be discussing like what we're working on now, what books we're all reading. And I think that actually goes very heavy into the notion of what's going on with Stevie as to why she's suddenly feeling very pulled in different directions, because I was going through that moment where I missed the simplicity of that versus now this is more of a profession. It's not as, oh, look at this new poem I wrote, or I'm reading this book, what are you reading? Now it's one of those, fuck, I have to decide this is a job. This isn't something I'm just hanging out with my friends on a curbside discussing.
Yeah, there's definitely like a bit of an innocence that gets lost as you get older, right? Like you start to look at your art more as practice rather than just pure inspiration. And I think that there's like a youthful energy that gets lost sometimes, which I think is why you sort of see mid-career bands take different directions on albums that like fans aren't necessarily always on board with, but like in some ways that's the artist maturing and being more thoughtful about their work and putting more practice into it, but they lose a bit of that rawness. And I think that that scene really captured that sort of raw energy that like people can only really have when they're young and they're just impulsive and they're going in different directions. And like, they're just kind of going with their gut. And I think that as you get a bit older, yeah, you start looking at it as a job or a practice, like something that to be serious about. And I think that's maybe like, that feels to me, correct me if I'm wrong, like the line that Stevie's kind of straddling a little bit or grappling with. Would you agree?
Yeah. It's an idea that's no longer just an idea. It's a commitment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you do millennial, I've told this to you before, but I think you do millennial disconnect and disaffect really, really well, really keenly. And that sort of came up in The Only Living Girl in Chicago as well, is that you take these characters that are kind of dealing with gig work and precariousness and, you know, kind of being glued to their phones and being anxious and kind of like, you know, watching things to kind of deal with their anxiousness, or like driving around to try and deal with their anxiousness and like pouring that out to their friends. And I wonder if that's a conscious influence that you try to explore, that sort of millennial experience. Or is it something that is intentional for you? Or do you find that, do you find it just kind of bleeds into the work naturally?
I think it bleeds into the work naturally, but as I was writing it, I did notice how much I was getting into those thoughts, and that's why I came up with the concept of the Great Saddening, and that was my attempt to explain why the characters are all feeling that way and why there's this kind of undercurrent of dissatisfaction and why they're working gig economy jobs and they don't know where they're going in life.
Yeah. Can you, for anyone who hasn't read the book, can you kind of like quickly summarize The Great Saddening? Cause I know we've done clips of it before when we were like doing promo for the book, but could you sort of roughly pitch that to anyone who doesn't quite know what it is yet?
Okay. Quick pitch. Well, The Great Saddening originated actually as The Big Sad, because I wanted it to seem more like The Big Bang. But after I sent this to my publisher, they told me that Adam Gennady actually wrote a book that was called Something in the Big Sad.
Oh, no.
I know. And I was just like, it, you know, it ended up coming up better for me, because then I started to actually think about how the 21st century is stuck under a cloud of pessimism and everything. And The Big Bang is kind of more of a sense of like doom, but there is no ambiguity with it. But then I started to think of The Great Saddening, and then I actually started comparing that more like with the Great Depression, where like it didn't stem from one pivotal moment, but a combination of things, and it can't be limited to just America. It's international, and the majority of the modern world is affected by this whole thing, you know? It's almost like a plague.
Yeah, there's...
you could blame nationalism, capitalism, whatever.
Yeah, there's a theory about generations that Strauss and Howe did. They wrote a big book on it, and it's kind of where we got those coined terms of like Gen X and millennial and boomer and all that stuff. And like they said that millennials were always going to come of age in a time of crisis. So in some ways, like if you subscribe to that theory, and it's a broad theory and not everyone sees it as being like international because they kind of based it in like Western turns of history. But if you subscribe to it, it says we were always going to come of age during a period of crisis. And that like, and I think that that's what we're seeing, right? And it definitely informs the mood of the book. And I think it informs, like you said, this kind of lingering pessimism, because like, you're sort of watching. Yeah, like you're watching everything crumble around you and trying to hang on to hope in spite of it. And I think that the choice to make things in the face of that is really brave, because it can feel really futile to create, or like in the face of so many other things that are going on in the world. But really it's this kind of connection that we're striving for, right? Or trying to keep alive in the face of a lot of really difficult things that go on in the world. And I think that that notion of trying to find tribe and connection and doing that in the face of the great saddening or all these awful things that we're coming of age with, that really resonates. And I think that those two things are inextricably linked, and it feels like your characters really embody that, because you've got, you know, artists and also gig workers and people that are in kind of situationships like Alfie and Stevie towards the end. And they're kind of like trying to figure out how to have this relationship with each other and how to navigate that. Just that the notion of millennial disaffect really comes through. I think that you do that really, really accurately. That's like what it feels like for me. So do you ever get people commenting on it that they feel like it's really relatable?
Yeah. I mean, almost everybody says the exact same thing that you said, that it is so millennial.
Yeah. Very, very millennial work. Tell me a bit about how the book came about. And I'd love to hear whether your environment helped inspire it. I know that you were writing in a cabin at one point, right? And I wonder, I know that you travel quite a bit as well. I'm wondering how much of this you wrote on the road and whether or not different environments kind of inspired it or informed it. Like you said that the book poured out of you. Tell us a bit about where you got the idea for the book and how it came about.
Well, we were going to a cabin in Indiana so I could actually write another book, which I'm working on now. But we were listening to a lot of music while driving there, and I just kept thinking about all my anxiety that I've been having. You know, like when you have like two podcasts and a publishing house and you're writing, there's this pressure you're constantly feeling of like, am I going to actually make a big thing out of this? Can I just drop out of this any moment? And that was just circling my mind so much while I was actually listening to some pretty cool playlists, and I think I shared one of them with you. So when we ended up at the A-Frame cabin in Indiana, I just told Belen, I was just like, how about you go kayaking and I'm just going to sit here and write. And the first thing that I turned on was Almost Famous. And I was just like, okay, this is a sign. I need to just start writing like this. So it poured out. I don't think that I had any really big grasp of what I was writing. I just knew who the main character was, what I wanted her to want, and where she was going to end up. And everything else was just happened fluidly. I wrote the book in about 2 weeks, but we only spent 3 days at that cabin. I wrote a lot of it while we were driving home on my notes app. And then, I just wrote it from home mainly. I actually shut everybody out. I even pissed off my therapist, actually, because I canceled on her.
For the art. Last minute. You did it for the art. It was only temporary, though, from the sound of it. So you really knocked this out pretty quick. 2 weeks is like a really short period of time. And how did it, I know you were considering a couple different publishers at one point. Like, how did it land with an X book? Because it felt like a really good fit for With an X, and it felt like it was just a thing that was kind of meant to be. Do you want to shout them out a little and talk about your experience working with them?
Well, I hadn't heard of With an X books until Drew Buxton sent me his book to write a blurb for it. And I was enamored with the cover of his book. And I was like, I need to see who these people are. So I already had them in like the back of my mind when I was thinking of submitting it. And then the more I actually looked up John Nix, the editor, his website, he does photography. And he was just making a documentary, which is out now, about a punk band. And I was just like, oh, this is destined. We need to do this. So I reached out to him. He didn't even seek me out. He was just like, oh, you just like my vibe? And I'm like, I like your vibe. Like, you don't even have to tell me anything else.
Yeah, no, it seems like it's just a really good fit. And they knock the design out of the park, too. I can't tell you, when I was, like, reading it in public or, like, over Christmas when I was visiting with friends, like, I had a lot of people sort of comment on it, and I was able to kind of say, my friend wrote this. And there's that amazing design of Hotel Xavier on the cover. And while I was reading it, I feel like I might have asked you this already, but for posterity, how many places in the novel, because you've traveled pretty widely, and I'm assuming you've been to LA a couple times at least, having written the book, is Hotel Xavier based on any one place? And I'm curious how many places in the novel are based on real places that you kind of wanted to capture the vibe of, but like didn't want to include directly in there.
Okay. Almost everywhere I mentioned in the book is real, except for Hotel Xavier and the record store. The record store is a record store in Echo Park, and it really reminded me of the record store in High Fidelity. So I was just like, I'm just going to fuck around with this. I want her to have that very John Cusack, like, I'm not even really working here vibe. But with Hotel Xavier, that is actually kind of a place in LA, but not really. It's based off of the Hotel Cecil, which is also the hotel that inspired Hotel California.
Yeah, that was my guess with the Cecil Hotel. And like, I was trying to remember it. I'm like, I'm pretty sure it's this one, but I don't want to don't want to be wrong about it. Have you been there? Do you know anyone that's been there? Like, and the scenes that were in there were so specific. The guy at the end of the bar who was like talking on the phone, like all those things. Did you draw them? I was reading it, like almost like you were somewhere witnessing this conversation and it bled into your work a little bit. Like you were the one in the hotel bar maybe. And I could be wrong, but, It felt like we were overhearing something the same way that Stevie was. And I was curious where you got the inspiration for that scene particularly. Because it's kind of, for anyone who hasn't read it, Stevie finds herself in this hotel bar and she's sort of drinking and she's talking with different people and she's overhearing a conversation that a man's having. Is it about someone's suicide or...
Your guess is as good as Stevie's.
Yeah, that's right. Because it's sort of this like really intimate thing that she's witnessing. And she winds up sort of, she drinks too much and she stays at the hotel?
That's another one that's up in the air.
Yeah, no one really knows. So I was sort of curious where the inspiration for that scene came from. Because it was very... it was very discomforting in that, like, you can kind of viscerally feel her spiraling out in this particular scene, but also sort of getting her bearings at the same time. Like, I was really curious about that scene in particular and, like, where the inspiration for it came from. And whether or not you stayed at the Hotel Cecil or if anyone you knew had stayed there, like, why that wound up factoring so prominently into this book.
I think that Hotel Cecil is actually now, I think it's either redesigned as lofts or housing for the unhoused.
Oh, no, they did that. They kind of, That's not bad if they did it for like urban infill and like affordable housing and stuff. But they did that with Hotel Chelsea. They kind of gentrified Hotel Chelsea too, right?
Ooh, it's affordable housing.
Oh, the Hotel Cecil is now? That's good.
Yeah, I just looked it up.
Yeah, that's really good. So haven't stayed there, obviously. But how did it sort of work its way from Hollywood lore into your book?
As I was saying, that music really heavily informed the writing and everything. And I actually, people hate me for this, I can't stand the song Hotel California. It is so...
Really?
Yeah. That's if just you ever like, do a karaoke night, there's always someone who'll do it.
That's one of those ones that I feel like when you're really hammered and, like, and it comes on, like you're just feeling that. It definitely feels like a thing that lots of us grew up with. I don't know. My dad was a big fan of the Eagles, so it was always just kind of like that, or like Don Henley was like one of the things that was just like on in my household all the time. And I feel like that was like a pretty common experience for lots of millennials with boomer parents, right? And you exactly. You hate the song? Really? How come?
Honestly, it's just because it's something I've heard way too much of. And also, I think sometimes you have a song that becomes linked to a person. You know, like how if an ex of yours is really obsessed with a song, you just can't listen to that anymore.
Yeah, that's fair.
I have a friend, they just are obsessed with the song and they sing it so badly where it just feels cringe to hear it. Like now I just always hear their voice.
They've ruined it for you because they're so tone deaf. Oh no. Is it like their karaoke fave?
It is every time.
Oh no. I hope. Well, if you're listening to this, cat's out of the bag, sorry, you got to choose a different song. Luckily the Eagles have lots of ones that you can choose. And Don Henley, I feel like, if I ever actually did karaoke, I would like to fuck up Dirty Laundry someday. I feel like that would be a most excellent cheesy one for karaoke. So,
have you ever done karaoke?
Very hammered and very sparingly. It takes a lot to get me up there because I'm shy and I don't like performance too much. And like, yeah, it takes a lot to get me up there. I feel like if I were a more... If I have liquid courage, then I can do it. But I'm extremely tone deaf. But what I lack in technical precision, I'll make up for with enthusiasm. But liquid courage, definitely needed. Do you do karaoke lots?
Not a lot. Again, it's same as you.
Do you have a go-to? What's like your anti-Hotel California?
I know what it was. I haven't done karaoke in a long time, though. It would be I Love Rock and Roll, Joan Jett.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a karaoke classic, I think.
Yeah. My friends and I, we kept trying to do Village People songs. That's just not good if you have too many drunk people singing that, though.
Yeah, I feel like YMCA is like a pretty classic one that like most people know, but...
We were really drunk and we had just watched the one Simpsons episode where Homer joins the Navy.
Yeah, in the Navy.
And we're like, yeah, we didn't know that there's so many lyrics to that song.
Oh, really?
Until we played that.
Is it one of those ones that just goes on forever?
Like, yeah, and like there's a lot of lyrics. It's not as simple as it is in the show.
Oh, no. So maybe not the best karaoke classic to be bringing up.
Really, honestly, is my friend who is mainly singing it. And like we'd be like, in the Navy.
Yeah.
We would jump in for that bit.
I feel like Hotel California is one of those songs. Was it really the Hotel Cecil? Because I feel like that's one that so many people apply to different hotels, like Chateau Marmont or like the Beverly Hills Hotel. Like I feel like it's just one of these things where like the lore gets kind of mixed up a little bit. So was it for sure about the Cecil Hotel?
Yep.
Oh, wild. Okay. I remember.
Oh, I did my research. That's how I decided like exactly how to design it.
Yeah, you really did. I stayed very briefly at Chateau Marmont a couple of years ago and like we just happened to hear someone playing Hotel California there. And I was like the window was open and someone was playing it somewhere. It must've been in a room. And I was like, I wonder how sick to death the staff gets of just hearing that song And now, like you said, knowing that it's not actually about the Chateau Marmont, like they probably got real sick of hearing it. Probably as sick as you are of hearing it.
I mean, I feel like if you work at like a classic hotel in LA, you're probably just used to it because they'd prior like tourists never know.
No.
What it's about. There's like, it's a hotel, Hotel California, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, again, the alcohol factors into it, I'm sure. People are very determined to have their experience.
But yeah, she wanted to find a place to disappear.
Yeah.
And that's a song that obviously encompasses that feeling. And I was like, where is she going to disappear to? Obviously, this place is the perfect place to be someone that no one knows who she is. Like, she could just be herself and not be performative. Nothing's expected of her. She could just be depressed and not give a fuck about anybody. She could be rude, which she is really rude. And yeah. You can't really do that with your friends, family, tribe, people you're working with. You're expected to be tuning in to their conversation, not just randomly, like, tuning them out and have them just talking at you and you're not even listening to them. And I wanted her to feel like she could actually have a place where she could just like be. And that's why I wanted all the different like voices to be going on. I wanted Lily to be this person who like will not shut up. And then she keeps being like, all right, I'm done listening to Lily. I just want to like disassociate. And then she's like overhearing this other douche bros conversation. So I'm just kind of going in between, in and out of that. I couldn't decide if I wanted the bartender to speak at all, but then I was just like, bartenders tend to be chill. They know to leave you be. So that's why I kept it like that.
Yeah, and I feel like hotels are really good for spaces that characters and people too, like this happens in real life, where like characters just sort of detach from their identities, right? Like it's one of those transitory spaces where you're not around anything that grounds you, that's like part of your normal everyday life. And so like, I think that fucks with a person's self-concept and identity. And like, very obviously Stevie is spiraling out a little bit about her life and she goes there, like you said, to disappear. And it just feels like she kind of disconnects with herself, or like you said, this performative self, in order to reconnect to herself. Yeah. And I think that hotels are really great for that narratively, because that's exactly what happens to people in real life, right? And I think we've all kind of had a moment either in like an airport or a hotel or like a gas station somewhere where
I like gas station. Awesome.
Yeah. Like, I just think any transitory space is like really adept for that narratively. So I liked the scene, and I liked how discomfited I was about the whole thing. And like, you get the sense that she's disconnecting or like dissociating, like you said, from herself, but in order to kind of reconnect, and you bring that back around. And I thought that bringing Alfie back around at the very end was like also a little bit of like reconnection as well. And he only kind of comes in at the end too. Why was that a choice? Cause I was so curious about this relationship. Like I selfishly wanted to see a bit more about it. So I was curious about why you only figured to like bring him in toward the end.
Because it's not a love story. And I was afraid that if I was going to have him there, people were going to be like, oh, this is someone who's so down and out, but they're going to focus solely on the romance. Once you put a love interest or a significant other of any kind, that's all anyone focuses on. So he was always going to be something that tethered her to the real world in some way. So one, he couldn't be there for a lot of the time because she was feeling untethered, and I could only reference him slightly. I just didn't want that whole romance situation to happen, because people with The Only Living Girl in Chicago, I had some obviously romance moments, and people read it wrong, and I just didn't want to do Stevie dirty like that. People were saying that like she was kind of hoey and stuff, and I was like, damn, like, no.
Really? That's so surprising. Yeah, that's fair. I think too, like there was some part of me that was like, you're right, subconsciously looking for like undercurrents of like romance or whatever. Like, and I respect that you kept her relationship with Finn very neutral and just as like.
So many people thought it was a love triangle.
I think that you nailed that millennial vibe with Alfie of like a situationship where like they're exes, but also they're kind of still in each other's lives. And he's just like this person who really knows her core self. And so of course it makes sense that when she reconnects with herself, she kind of reconnects with him, but not like you said, in the way where like, it's the focal point of the book. That only happens after the fact. And she has to do all that work herself. And I think too, that, you do a good job of kind of like, I don't want to say friend zoning Finn, but like it's maybe a little bit what happens, I guess, or like they're just each other's support in that way that like everyone in this book is in their 20s, right?
I don't think I actually give a hard age for Finn.
Yeah.
But everyone else is like late 20s, mid to late 20s.
Yeah, it felt very much of that time, because there's sort of a, I don't know, like a disconnect that happens later. I remember being in my mid 20s and just like being at house parties and everyone just sort of like wakes up everywhere and like people's beds, and it's just like not, it's not a big deal, or you'll like go out with a friend and be driving around for hours and it's not a thing. And I feel like that sort of fades with age. So I thought that you pulled that off really well in terms of making them more neutral and just sort of like supports and part of her tribe, as opposed to like a romance. That's interesting to me that that was like one thing you intentionally avoided too. Was there anything else that you intentionally wanted to avoid when you were writing the book?
Well, I mean, obviously I wanted to avoid any form of convention. I didn't want people to actually know where Stevie was headed. So I guess in that way, I did intentionally always leave the band out of it. That was purposeful. I just wanted people to only interact with the band through texts. I wanted people to only know who she was and how she was experiencing it. And like, they're almost like offset. They're a non-entity in the book. And that's better because that's how it is in her mind. So you have that. And I am very intentional with Finn. I wanted Finn to be a guy no matter what. I didn't want it where people were going to think that like he's being friend-zoned or whatever. I wanted to make it more clear that not only does tribe not be your family, it could be either gender, any sexuality, any age. I'm not sure how much I conveyed that last part, because some people do think that like Finn was a little used by Stevie.
But that's more about what the reader's bringing to it than like that's reader projection. So I don't necessarily think that's like a fault of your narrative so much. I think that's like I use the word friend zone because that's what I projected into it, right? I don't think that's necessarily like a flaw in the way that you've presented it. I think it challenges our ways of thinking about tribe. And you've obviously like, you've been striving for something that's like a more inclusive idea and something that's like not necessarily sexual. It doesn't have to be. Tribe is just, it's found family, and Finn is very obviously Stevie's found family. Right? Yes,
same with Claire, who's suddenly just bulldozing her way into the family.
Yeah, exactly. I can't get over the fact that you didn't see Empire Records till after. Did you have a lot of people comparing those sorts of characters to, or like that dynamic or vibe between them to Empire Records? Because that, it feels...
Almost everybody who wrote a blurb for the book messaged me, and like they're naming the movies that it reminded them of.
Almost Famous was another.
Yeah, Almost Famous and High Fidelity were the ones where I could be like, I've seen those. And then I want to say like Jessamine Violet, she's the one that like gave the most like, it's like this, 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 or that. I only had watched Reality Bites like right before writing this.
Yeah, Reality Bites is like such a, I had only watched it in the last couple of years, and it's so deeply Gen X, right? And there's still like very, yeah, like there's still like, there's traces of that in here for sure. I think it's like helpful to compare it in terms of like, and those are all cult favorites, right? Or like not even cult favorites, but like generational favorites. So I think that speaks to how well that you've channeled that in your books, even without noticing or trying or like having seen those movies right away. So I think that you've nailed something in terms of the way that we bond with people in our 20s, that like you just in our teens and 20s, that you just can't replicate as you get older without it being kind of weird.
So cool.
Yeah.
If we could though.
Yeah, like, and I don't want to be cynical about it, but I just find like the older I get, like tribe, you still can find tribe, I think. I just don't think it's like as sustained as when you're younger and you have a lot more time to like hang out and kind of fuck around and find out. And maybe artists do a little bit more of this than the average person. But there's something
I was going to say. You went to AWP this year, right?
Yeah, and I was actually just thinking about that. I can't sit here having gone to AWP and say with my whole chest like tribe doesn't exist for artists, because it obviously does. But the thing with AWP,
I'll say we're all family.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing with AWP is that it's kind of gatekept by like the cost of it, right? So not everyone gets to kind of participate in this tribe aspect. So like it is good for that. But I do think that people sort of being in each other's orbit when they're younger and being able to sort of freely talk about their anxieties, about their art, and also about their life, it's just a thing that gets harder to do as you get older. And anyway, all of this to say is like in praise of the book, how well you've captured that kind of tension and relatability and that feeling of connection between young people, and particularly between young artists who are just hopeful and kind of need their friends a little bit to like prop them up when they're anxious about things. So I like that a lot. 2 weeks. Wow. This came out in 2 weeks.
Yeah. A lot of people don't believe that either.
No, I believe it. If that's what you say, if that's how long you say it took you to write it.
I was having like a Jack Kerouac moment with this where even I was just like, I wrote it? Wow.
Yeah, like you just kind of have to go with it, right? And I think you can't always tell when inspiration's going to strike. And like that winds up being what happens with Stevie, is that she reconnects with herself. Maybe it's sort of in the same way that you did. And were you also sort of experiencing like hitting a bit of a creative wall prior to writing the book? Like did your experience inform Stevie's in terms of like the tension between like artistic blocks and like sudden bursts of inspiration?
Well, my biggest thing at that point was that I was really sick and tired of everybody saying Mallory Smart, the editor-in-chief of Malden House. And it occurred to me that I really wasn't putting my own work first. And then all everybody was ever seeing was The Only Living Girl in Chicago. And I felt like I wasn't really able to replicate that same excitement again. And I wanted to do it again, but in a way where people wouldn't confuse the main character with me. So I was struggling a lot with what to write and how I could actually create an atmosphere where people are like, this isn't Mallory, this is Cyan Mallory created. And yeah, it was really hard for me to actually get into that zone. So it was really exciting when I did. And yeah.
Yeah, I think that's like a mistake that lots of people make with fiction, especially, is that sort of transference of like, oh, this must be exactly what the author was going through at that time. And I hope you didn't feel like I was conflating the two. I certainly wasn't.
Oh no, everybody does.
Yeah, exactly. It's just that
I do it too with other people.
It's a thing. And I think too, when we know the person writing the book, there's some element of like, oh, you're on this page as a person. And I can tell that, like, I remember, you know, there's certainly more than a few people in the last like couple of years where I've read their books and been like, this is absolutely you. even as it's not you, even as it's fiction, like you are coming out on this page to me. And I say that as a compliment. I think that finding someone's voice on the page is really exciting. And you're always sort of like tracking with what you know of them and trying not to project too much on it, but it's sometimes it's hard not to. So do you want to tell me at all about the Night Drive playlist? I steered away a little bit from it just because it was a lot to chew on. Like there's 200 songs on there. Was that specific to this book, or is it just like something you use generally for your inspiration while you're writing?
It's actually what I listen to while I'm driving a lot.
Oh, like that makes total sense. But do you draw inspiration from it? Did you draw inspiration from it for the book, or was that more like
as I said, I was like listening to the music while I was like, it was like a 2 or 3 hour drive to that cabin.
Yeah.
So I was definitely getting lost in the music while driving. I kind of disassociate myself while I'm driving and listening to music. I don't know if anyone else has that issue.
Yeah, that's fair. I miss driving and playing tunes, to be honest. I'm like going to be buying a car pretty soon, I think. And so I really miss having that experience. There's something about being in a car when I'm editing for Major Seventh. I'm always like, so you'd think I'd get sick of hearing about people bonding with music in cars or like their experience with music in cars. And I never do. Never, ever. Like I'll never get sick of that just because I think it's pretty universal experience, right? Like there's something, it's like your own private world a little bit, and whether or not there's someone else in the car with you, like I think that makes total sense. I also love that you wrote, it's very millennial that you wrote so much of it on your notes app.
Yeah, you know, I would actually say it's not totally millennial though.
Well, Gen Z maybe does too.
Oh, I was actually trying to figure out how old Bud Smith is.
Oh, yeah, that's right, because he was drafting while he was at work, right? That's a pretty well-known thing. So I shouldn't be ageist. Excuse me. Excuse the
Whoever
fuck out of me.
Whoever happens to go on their iPhones. Well, now I'm being mean to people who don't have iPhones. Whoever's just writing on their phones.
Yeah, no, I think that's great, and I think that's... like such a good example, Bud Smith particularly, having been so successful. Just like using whatever's available to you and whatever time you have, and not making writing precious is such an inspiring thing. It just sort of tells you, or like Kevin Maloney is always tweeting about like writing on his phone in the bathtub and stuff. I love that. Just taking whatever time you can and using whatever tools you can and taking inspiration where it goes. Was there anything else you wanted to like talk about, any artists or anything particular on the book playlist that you were like really fond of, or like did you want to talk about any ways that some of those songs really inspired the book more than others?
Well, I mean, I already stated, well, I didn't state in the one piece I had you publish about Telephone Line, I had that going on repeat all throughout the writing. And then actually, as I was getting ready to do all the promo, I don't know what it is about that song. Just the whole, it almost feels haunting. It almost feels like you can feel your like soul leaving your body for a minute while listening to that. And yeah, that's probably one of my favorite on the playlist. That and Sweet Jane by Cowboy Junkies.
For anyone listening who isn't already aware, when I first launched Major Seventh Magazine, which is a literary mixtape, and it's like flash pieces that are inspired by music, and they're usually titled with a song. In the first volume, Mal submitted a piece from Alfie's point of view and titled it Telephone Line by Electric Light Orchestra, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the piece she's referring to. And I like that you gave us that sort of complimentary aspect to it before the book was even released, because you're right, it is haunting, and it is sort of like emblematic a bit of their relationship and how it feels very unfinished. And they're still in each other's lives. And yeah, I hate to keep using the word situationship, but...
Oh, I'm actually like adoring this term. I've never heard anyone use it.
Oh, really? It's like, it's, I think, very deeply, like, pretty embedded in millennial culture that anything that's, like, not clearly defined is, like, boyfriend, girlfriend. So, like, hookup culture, if you're not calling it hooking up, you're calling it a situationship where, like, maybe sometimes you hang out and maybe sometimes you're fucking and maybe sometimes you have history, but you're not boyfriend, girlfriend. Like, situationship is anything that's just sort of, like, messy. Like, if you think about it's complicated on Facebook, if anyone was still using Facebook, that would be a situationship. So we've been fucking with that.
I feel like my life hasn't been messy enough now.
Yeah, like, I feel like it, at least everyone has had maybe at least one or two situationships in their life. Like, maybe some people have more than others, but I feel too, like, with the rise of dating apps, it's a thing that happens more and more often where there's just stuff that isn't defined, right? And to me, Alfie and Stevie sort of have this dynamic where they're in each other's lives, but it's not technically romantic anymore, but they know each other in that way and they're still supporting each other and seeing the other side of it in this piece. If you ever want to go look it up, it's on Major 7th Magazine. It's Mallory's only piece for this. And if you like the book enough, you should go look up Alfie's side of it. It's a little flash piece. It's inspired by the ELO song. Yeah, I think that's about all the questions I have. Was there anything else you wanted to talk about or...
Well, I can't think of anything. You know, I do have one question for you, actually.
Shoot, yeah.
Do you think that they ended up touring?
Oh, that's a good one. I wanted to go back, before I answer this, I wanted to go back briefly to say that I like that you kept the band on the periphery. And it's interesting to me to know that you did that very intentionally. Because I do agree that this was like a journey that Stevie had to go on herself. Did they wind up touring? My sense of it at the end was that she was just working on the work. You know what I mean? She was just getting into her artistic practice and trying to reconnect with that as opposed to just like this push for touring. So
that's cool.
Yeah. Like my thought, my kind of overwhelming feeling at the end was that she wasn't in a space to be touring because she'd only just reconnected with her artistic practice and with her artistic inspiration. Right. And I feel like particularly for bands and touring musicians that those things tend to go, they have to be balanced. Like there's the time to be on the road, which is like output. And also input from, I guess, fans and stuff. Right. But there's also that's the very externalized version of being a musician and it has its place, but I think it also has to be tempered with these sort of quieter moments where, yeah, you're just going to go spiral out in a hotel and drink for a bit and fuck yourself up and not be performing. So I think that tour has to be tempered. Not that I fucking know, I'm not a musician, but to me it feels like those things have to happen in balance. Like it's artistic practice is like breathing, right? There has to be inhaling inspiration and inhaling all the things around you that inform your work and then exhaling the work and exhaling your performance, right? So I don't...
By the way, I do love that we're both non-musicians who wrote books about musicians.
Yeah, I know. It's giving me insane imposter syndrome lately, if I'm being honest. I'm like... Because I'm having people that are like actual musicians or like people who are connected with the music industry reading it. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? But yeah, we did that. I mean, I think that... when you sort of grow up fascinated with musicians' lives and like the lore of it, it's hard not to take, to want to write your own story for that. Right. So I don't have a good, and I feel like I don't have a good answer for your question, but If I had to,
good answer.
If I had to give a succinct answer, I would say no. I would say that the way I felt it finished was that she had work to do on another album, on her songs, and that she wasn't quite ready to be touring yet.
All right. That was Kirsty McKenzie again interviewing me. Very interesting experience. I actually had a great time. She had some better questions than I actually could have ever come up with. So, hell yeah, Kirsty. To learn more about her, hit her up on her Twitter at Kirsty Mack and take a look at her website, Major 7 Mag, which focuses on music and literature. Again, perfect fit. And if you like this interview, then that means you might actually be intrigued by my book, I Keep My Visions to Myself, from Within X Books. So please check it out. You can get it at Within X Books, Amazon, honestly, wherever you buy it, doesn't matter. Within X Books is probably better. I'm a supporter of small presses, if you haven't learned this by now. But, you know, be sure to check the show notes for all the proper spellings and links. As always, please check out our Twitter at PodHealing and take a look at our website, textualpodcast.com. Show us support by going onto Apple Podcasts and leaving us a 5-star review or subscribing to us on Spotify. And of course, don't forget to check out our Patreon. You can find a link to it on our Twitter. This is Mallory Smart. Tune in next Saturday for an off-the-record episode with Jillian Left. I hope you enjoyed the show.